Welcome to African American Conservatives, your source for political news and commentary from a cultural and right-of-center perspective. African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement.
Today's sponsor is audibletrial.com. They have more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/AACONS. That's www.audibletrial.com/AACONS.
Good evening and welcome to African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. I'm your host, Marie Strotter, and tonight our guests are Professor Ilya Soman and William S. King. As a reminder to our listeners, these segments are pre-taped for the convenience of our guests. And first up, we have Professor Ilya Soman. Ilya Soman is Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law. He is a regular contributor for the Washington Post Volokh Conspiracy blog and is the author or co-author of several books, including The Grasping Hand, Kilo v. City of New London, and The Limits of Eminent Domain. Professor Soman has recently released a second edition of his 2013 book, Democracy and Political Ignorance, Why Smaller Government is Smarter, which he will discuss with us today. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
George Will, in a column that reviewed your book, Democracy and Political Ignorance, quoted Winston Churchill as saying, quote, "The best argument against democracy is a five-minute conversation with the average voter," end quote. How extensive is the problem of political ignorance that you would have to write that, quote, "The sheer depth of most individual voters' ignorance may be shocking to readers not familiar with the research," end quote.
Well, there's some controversy about whether Winston Churchill actually said that, but it's certainly the case that the sentiment behind that quote is correct. And the reason is that voter ignorance is a very severe problem, and it's extremely widespread. For example, in the 2014 election, which decided control of Congress, that was the main stake in it, polls taken not long before the election showed that only 38% of the public even knew which party controlled the House of Representatives before the election, and about the same number knew which party controlled the Senate. Similarly, even though we've been debating the federal budget and its problems for quite a few years now, surveys repeatedly show that most of the public has little or no idea of how the federal government actually spends its money. They massively underestimate spending on entitlement programs like Medicare and Social Security, even though those are probably the largest items in the federal budget. On the other hand, they massively overestimate spending on foreign aid, which is really only about 1% of the budget, but the average voter is just 10 to 20 times higher than that. And there are many, many other issues, lots of which I discuss in the book, where voters, most of them lack even very basic knowledge of what is going on.
Yankees fans and Red Sox fans may both be very well informed, but they are so for their own gratification, as no amount of knowledge we may have about our prospective teams will affect the outcomes of the game. And if one is not a baseball fan or just a casual one, or a baseball fan with no interest in the Yankees or Red Sox, there is no reason why one would feel compelled to know the difference between Big Poppy and A-Rod, even if one is very well informed in other areas. Does this analogy we've attempted to paraphrase based upon one you drew in Democracy and Ignorance help provide a clearer understanding of what you mean by rational ignorance?
Yes. So for most people, being ignorant about politics is not the result of stupidity. It's the result of perfectly rational behavior. The chance that your vote will affect an electoral outcome is infinitesimally small. So if your only reason to become a better voter is to make good choices in an election, that means that you have very little incentive to acquire political knowledge. Now, of course, there are some people who acquire knowledge about particular things, even though they have very little chance of affecting outcomes. And sports fans are a good example of this. Yankees and Red Sox fans realize that they have very little chance of affecting the outcome of games, but they find it enjoyable and interesting to learn about their favorite teams and also to hang out with their fellow fans. And just as sports fans do this when it comes to sports information, so there is a minority of people who in the book I call political fans who enjoy cheering on their preferred party or candidate or ideology, and they know a lot more about politics than the average person does. But there is a problem, and that is that when you're acquiring information not for the purpose of getting at the truth, but for the purpose of enhancing your fan experience, you will tend to acquire it in a very biased way. So just as big sports fans tend to be extremely biased in favor of their favorite teams, so big political fans also tend to be highly biased. The evidence suggests that they tend to reject any evidence which cuts against their pre-existing views while overvaluing anything that cuts in favor of them. It is even the case that they tend to only discuss politics with people who have the same views as they do and mostly seek out political information only in media which has views that they agree with. If you were a real truth seeker, as John Stuart Mill famously pointed out, what you would want to do is seek out information sources that don't agree with you, because they're the ones that are most likely to provide you with arguments and information that you haven't heard before.
You emphasize that, quote, "It is notable that the level of political knowledge in the American electorate has increased only modestly, if at all, since the beginning of mass survey research in the late 1930s. A relatively stable level of ignorance has persisted even in the face of massive increases in educational attainment and an unprecedented expansion in the quantity and quality of information available to the general public at little cost," end quote. Why is it that even at a time when we can Google on our cell phones a volume of information that would be almost unimaginable for someone to discover in a day at a public library only a generation ago, we are not significantly less politically ignorant? Is it all just a matter of lack of motivation to be so?
It is mostly lack of motivation. There's no doubt that information has become much more available than ever before, but it still takes time and effort to process that information, think about it, learn it, consider its implications. And while you can definitely use Google to find political information, you can also use Google and the internet generally to do a lot of other stuff, such as keep up with Taylor Swift and her latest boyfriend or with the NBA finals or whatever might happen to interest you. And for a lot of people, they feel that they prefer to do these other things rather than use the internet and other technology to keep up with political knowledge. As I said before, this is perfectly understandable and rational, but it still has harmful consequences for society. I would also add that the failure of political knowledge to increase significantly despite these technological changes and despite increasing education, I think that strengthens the case for the argument that I make in the book, that the problem here is one of the demand for information, not the supply. The problem is not that information isn't available to us. It's that most people, for understandable reasons, don't want to spend more than a minimal amount of time learning about politics and thinking about the relevant data.
Which I think is interesting, because what guy Taylor Swift is dating, or who wins the NBA finals, although I have to say the Warriors are playing, ultimately doesn't have anything to do with my life. However, whomever I vote for or whatever issue I vote for could ultimately have a tremendous effect on me. So that lack of motivation is really interesting.
Yeah, so It's true, probably Taylor Swift and the NBA Finals won't have any direct effect on your life, but many people just find them interesting and exciting, right? Some
right.
people feel the same way about politics, but the political fans I mentioned earlier, but they're only a relatively small minority of the population. So for the vast majority of people whose only reason to acquire knowledge about politics is to be a better voter, that turns out not to be much of an incentive at all, because although obviously who wins can have an effect on your life, you have only a tiny chance of having any effect on who wins. So I think if you were presented with a situation where you got to personally decide who will be the next president of the United States or the next governor of your state or the next mayor of your community, you would probably spend much more time thinking about that situation and thinking about the relevant arguments for the different sides than most voters actually do in an election. But mm-hmm. what you actually have is one chance in many millions, or at best one chance out of many thousands, of deciding the electoral outcome. And for most people, that's not a sufficient motivation to make more than a minimal effort.
You discuss four theories that seek to put forth a required level of voter knowledge. Let's focus on the Burkean trusteeship theory. What is it, and what are some of the flaws you find in this theory?
So the Burkean trusteeship theory is named after Edmund Burke, the great 18th century conservative political thinker. And what Burke said is that what voters should really be doing, perhaps, is not choosing what the best policies are, but rather choosing what the best people are that we can entrust with political power to make those decisions for us. So perhaps we should elect people who are virtuous, knowledgeable, and have all kinds of other good qualities, and elect them to Congress and the presidency and so on, and then they can make all the difficult policy decisions for us. I think there's a couple problems with this theory from the standpoint of political knowledge. One is that it actually requires a good deal of knowledge to know what kind of personality actually will make for a good political leader. Donald Trump, for example, says, well, I'm a great businessman, that means I'll be a great president. Well, not necessarily, not so fast, because it may be that business and politics are very different kinds of realms which call for different skills. So in order to know what kind of person will make a good political leader, you actually need to know a good deal about how political decision making works, how public policy works, and so forth. Secondly, another problem with this theory is that even a personally virtuous person, or who otherwise has tremendous ability, they may have ideological views which are counterproductive or harmful. Politics isn't just about some sort of neutral application of expertise. It is also about ideological differences about how the world works, what our principles should be, and so forth. So, for example, I happen to think that President Obama has many of the personal qualities that we would want in a president, but I also think his ideology is badly flawed. So the fact that he has these personal virtues doesn't necessarily mean that he's a good president overall. So I think those are among the problems with the trusteeship theory. Finally, I would mention that Burkean trusteeship is not very comforting in a world where often the voters don't even know the names of many of the candidates, and even if they know their names, they often know very little about them other than whether they're a Democrat or a Republican. Even if you believe in the Burkean trusteeship theory, the voters' level of knowledge often falls below what that theory would require us to have.
Many have found the proposed solutions to political ignorance to be undemocratic, as taking away power and responsibility from the average American to hand over to some elite group. This sort of criticism can also be found in critiques of judicial review. You quote Robert Bork, for example, as saying that the judicial invalidation of legislation is objectionable because it creates, quote, new disabilities for democratic governments, end quote. You also include Alexander Bickel's comment that, quote, the root difficulty is that judicial review is a counter-majoritarian force in our system, end quote. Clarence Thomas reflected that the concern of many conservatives and liberal legal experts by asking of his fellow judges, quote, What restrains us from imposing our personal preferences under the guise of constitutional interpretation, end quote. Even Thomas Jefferson argued that Thomas Jefferson judicial review is, quote, a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy, end quote. You argue judicial review, quote, might actually alleviate the impact of political ignorance and thereby strengthen popular control of government, end quote. How so?
It can do so in two ways. One is judicial review can enforce provisions of the Constitution that limit the power of the federal government and thereby leave more authority to states and local governments. When decisions are made at a more local level, we have the option of voting with our feet, of deciding where we are going to live based on differences in public policy. And when we vote with our feet, we have much better incentives to be informed than when we vote at the ballot box, because we know that that's a choice that will actually make a difference. And therefore, lots of research, some of which I discuss in the book, indicates that people actually make pretty good decisions when they decide where they want to live, much better than decisions they make at the ballot box. The second way in which judicial review can help empower ordinary people and alleviate the problem of political ignorance is by protecting individual rights and taking the government out of some areas of life entirely. For example, if they protect individual economic liberties or property rights or social freedom of various kinds, that means the decisions in question will be made not by the government or not by judges, by the way, either, but by free individuals deciding for themselves. And when people make their own individual decisions in the private sector, they also have a much stronger incentive to be well-informed than when they vote at the ballot box. Consider that if you're like most people, you probably spent more time and effort acquiring information the last time you decided which car or TV set to buy than the last time you decided who to vote for president or any other political office. That's not because you think the TV is more important than who controls the government. It's because you know that your decision about the TV set will actually make a difference. And so if more decisions are made in the realm of individual freedom, in the market and civil society, then more decisions will be made in at least a relatively well-informed manner. And this also suggests that the case for judicial review of this kind is actually not elitist. It is actually in favor of empowering ordinary people by helping them to vote with their feet, keeping government out of some areas entirely, and in other areas decentralizing government. So I wouldn't want judges to run our lives. What I would want is for judges to be able to curb the excesses of other branches of government, to limit their powers, not to empower the judges, but rather to empower the rest of us so that we can more effectively vote with our feet and be able to make better decisions about aspects of our lives, where when we make those decisions at the ballot box, we have tremendous incentives to be poorly informed and also to be very biased in the way that we process information.
Recently, President Obama gave a speech in which he boasted about the economic accomplishments of his administration. The president mentioned that under his tenure, the unemployment rate has been cut in half. He did not mention that this is largely due to the labor force participation rate dropping to near record lows. The president mentioned that under him, the deficit has been slashed, but did not mention that the national debt continues to increase at great speed and is expected to explode past $20 trillion momentarily. We would be sure that these oversights were just carelessness on the part of the president's speechwriters, but since you wrote, quote, voter ignorance plays an important role in enabling the use of deception to enact even very important laws, end quote, we are beginning to have our doubts. Could it be that politicians exploit and or manipulate voter ignorance for their own ends?
I think it happens all the time. the data that I just mentioned from my book about how ignorant voters are much of the time, this is not news to politicians and political strategists. They know that they can take advantage of this, and they repeatedly do. It's happened under the Obama administration. It's also been done by the Republicans. One well-known example from the Obama administration is Jonathan Gruber, one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, saying that the ACA was passed in part by exploiting the, quote, stupidity of the American voter, as he called it. For example, President Obama famously promised that if you like your health insurance, you can keep it. He almost certainly knew at the time that this was a false statement, because the whole point of the act in many cases was to force people to buy more expensive and different health insurance than they had before, but he was able to get away with it for a time at least because of political ignorance. And of course, on the other side of the political spectrum, Donald Trump in the 2016 campaign has built much of his success on exploiting ignorance. So both Democratic and Republican politicians are well aware of this, even though they like to pretend that they aren't and that they think that the voters are well informed, they routinely exploit the ignorance for their benefit and sometimes also for the benefit of powerful interest groups.
Since you mentioned Donald Trump, you wrote for The Washington Post that, quote, some conservatives who otherwise have little use for Donald Trump console themselves with the thought that he might at least appoint good judges to the federal courts, end quote. And indeed, Mr. Trump has released a list of names that seem to be quite favorable to right-thinking legal experts. Why then do you add, quote, there is good reason to fear that a President Trump would appoint judges who are likely to be a menace to our constitutional rights, especially from a conservative, libertarian, or originalist perspective, end quote.
It is often said by people who don't like Trump that he's unreliable and doesn't have a consistent record on anything. But in this very limited way, I'll actually come to his defense. He does have a consistent record on at least two important constitutional issues, both of which should be very troubling to conservatives and libertarians and really Americans more generally. One is he has a longstanding record of saying that he should be able to use lawsuits such as libel suits and also other mechanisms such as regulatory harassment to suppress his critics. He's taken this position on restricting freedom of speech since long before he started his presidential campaign. The second issue on which he has a longstanding record is the issue of property rights and eminent domain, where he was famously involved as far back in the 1990s in several takings where he wanted to condemn people's homes to transfer property to his business interests. He could build a casino parking lot, for example, and he has repeatedly said that it's a great thing if government can take property for virtually any reason, give it to people like himself. He has praised the Supreme Court's QO decision, which said that the government can take property from one private individual and give it to another in order to, quote, promote economic development, even though they don't even have to prove that the development will actually materialize. These positions on these issues are troubling in and of themselves, but they also have broader implications because if, as is likely, he would appoint judges that share his views on these issues, which he cares about intensely, then those judges are also likely to be very bad on a great many other issues, other free speech issues, other property rights issues. More generally, as Josh Blackman has shown in a good article in the National Review, he has a very strong position against any kind of limits on his executive power. He has said he would use the same kinds of executive orders as Barack Obama has, only perhaps even more extensively. So he is, in general, against some very important individual rights protected by the Constitution, particularly freedom of speech and property rights. And he also is opposed to separation of powers, limits on executive power. He's even gone so far as to say that he thinks it would be perfectly fine for him to order American troops to massacre civilians in the war on terror. And that he said, well, the troops will, of course, obey me if I do that because I'm a leader. I think Donald Trump is not just a blank slate when it comes to constitutional issues. He has a record of strong positions on many of them, and he, like most presidents, would want to appoint judges who are consistent with his views. Now, it is true that he released that list, but he himself has said that the list is not actually binding and that he reserves the right to choose people who are not on the list if he wants to. So people who are comforting themselves with the list, I think they're at the very least being very over-optimistic and are ignoring other more long-term aspects of his record.
In the past, our audience has heard you discuss political ignorance with us as we asked you to explain the theory popular among legal scholars called original meaning originalism. So it would follow that many would wonder how the two might tie together. You once wrote that, quote, the reality of widespread political ignorance poses a serious challenge for original meaning originalism, end quote. How so?
So this requires us to go into the weeds of the theory of originalism a little bit. So I ask forgiveness in advance if there turns out to be too much complexity. But when originalism first became a big focus of debate among judges and legal scholars 30 or 40 years ago, the version of originalism that people promoted was original intent originalism. What were the intentions of the people who wrote the Constitution, and what is it that they were trying to do? People like James Madison, for example. But over time, for reasons we can talk about if you want, original intent originalism gave way among most experts to original meaning originalism, which focuses not on what did the people who drafted the Constitution want to do, but rather on how was the Constitution understood by people at the time generally. That is, if you were reading the Constitution back in 1787 when it was written, how would you interpret it? What would be the meaning of it to you at that time? Now, if the original meaning originalism that you espouse focuses on how the Constitution was understood by ordinary people, then you might have a big problem, because in the 18th and 19th century, like today, there probably was a considerable amount of political ignorance, and many ordinary people simply weren't following these debates and may not have known much about what particular provision of the Constitution might have meant, or even perhaps read them. Now, there are some versions of original meaning originalism that are not much affected by this problem because they focus not on what ordinary people thought, but rather on what legally informed people believed, or some hypothetical construct might have believed, a hypothetical well-informed person, for example. In some of my work, I call this the elitist as opposed to the populist approach to original meaning originalism. But if you want to focus on the highly informed minority of the population, then you're essentially cutting out of the process the vast bulk of the people. So more can be said about this. I don't think the problem of political ignorance completely invalidates original meaning originalism, but it does pose a challenge, because often it will be very hard to tell what ordinary people thought about a particular provision, because many of them might not even have known about it, and those who did know about it might not have more than a very superficial understanding of what it might have meant.
You say, quote, democratic control of government works better when there is less government to control, end quote. Would you please explain?
Sure. One of the many problems with political ignorance today is the enormous size, scope, and complexity of government. We currently have levels of government spending which amount to 35 or even 40% of gross domestic product, and government regulates almost every aspect of human activity, down to even what kind of toilet seats you can have or what kind of light bulbs and so forth. And even among those people who pay closer attention to politics than the average voter does, it's almost impossible for them to keep track of more than a small fraction of that government activity. So if we had a more limited government that focused on a narrower range of issues, the knowledge and information burden on voters would be less severe, and democratic accountability would work better. We would no longer have this sort of massive leviathan where very few, if any, voters actually have any idea of most of what the government is doing.
If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has been Professor Ilya Somin. He has recently released a second edition of his 2013 book, Democracy and Political Ignorance, Why Smaller Government is Smarter. What's next for you, and how can we continue to follow your work?
So I'm going to be doing a series of talks and presentations about the book, and the book is available online at Amazon and other similar websites. In addition, I blog regularly at the Volokh Conspiracy blog, V-O-L-O-K-H, which is located at the Washington Post website. I write about political ignorance, but also some of the other issues that we talked about, like constitutional law, for example.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay tuned for William S. King.
Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/AACONS and choose from over 180,000 audio programs. Download a free title and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/AACONS. That's audibletrial.com/AACONS and get started today. Why Audible? Audible content includes more than 180,000 audio programs from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. You can get books from some of your favorite ACONS guests, including Alan West, Guy Benson, Kirsten Powers, Peter Schweitzer, and others. So go to audibletrial.com/AACONS.
This is African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Our guests tonight are Professor Ilya Somin and now William S. King.
Brian Kaplan is a professor of economics at George Mason University, a research fellow at the Mercatus Center, and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. He's also a blogger for EconLog. He's the author of Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids and The Myth of the Rational Voter. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
You are known to your many fans, who we have heard referred to as Kaplanites, for your many passions. Among the ones listed are your family, economics, libertarianism, role-playing games, and immigration. While some of these passions may seem unique, with the GOP president forerunner promising to build the greatest, most spectacular, most everything wall the world has ever seen on our southern border, and each of the Democratic candidates offering to greet illegals at the border with everything short of a warm towel and pillow mint, it seems as though, on that last point, at least the political world agrees with you. How did immigration become such a passion for you?
How did it become such a passion for me? Well, let's see. I guess that it really started, in my last year of high school and college, when I just thought about the way that different people in the world get treated, and how, in general, people think that it's really bad to treat someone badly just because they chose the wrong parents, proverbially. And then realizing that, if you happen to be born on the wrong side of a national border, you really are treated not like a second-class citizen. You are treated like not a citizen at all, which is quite poorly. When I started reading more economics and realizing how the economic case for immigration is so strong, then the contrast between what seems like the evil that pretty much every country does and the economic case in favor of being good was just very striking to me.
Strikingly, for an economist, people known to present their case with all sorts of statistics, graphs, and mathematical formulas, your argument for open borders is, or at least very reminiscent of, a moral crusade. You even once wrote, quote, "I save my moral outrage for Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, immigration restrictions," end quote. Is the argument against open borders then simply evil?
Here's the way that I think about it. On the face of it, saying that someone is not allowed to live and work in a country because they were born on the wrong side of the border seems like a bad thing to do to a person. So if, say, you were born in Haiti and someone said, well, because you happen to be born in Haiti, like, the best job you ever can get is whatever you can get in Haiti. The best place you can live is what you can find in Haiti. That seems like a pretty bad thing to do to a person for no reason. And then the real question, then the secondary question is, so, you know, are there actually some really good arguments for doing this to people, even though it seems like a very harsh thing to do? And that's where I do become a social scientist and take a look at the evidence and say, well, how good are the arguments for excluding people from working and living where they want to? And there I would say, you know, I'm much more like an economist where I come to the evidence and say, seems like that, you know, not only is there not a very good case for restricting migration in the way that almost every country does, but actually there are enormous economic benefits of allowing free migration. So, you know, in general, the economic case for free migration is really the same as the economist's general case for free trade. So if goods are allowed to flow to anywhere on Earth, then they'll go to the places where they are most productive and most useful. So, for example, you know, with, say, food, you don't go and keep food on the farms where it's grown because the food is much more useful in other places on Earth than on the farms, because most of the people that want to eat the food are not there. Right, and the essence of prosperity is really taking the things that are produced in one place and moving to places where they actually do the most good. But for human labor, there is a very strong effort by governments around the world to make sure that people do not leave their country of origin, to make it really hard to do that. And the result of this is that most human talent on Earth actually really does get wasted, because there are so many people living in unproductive parts of the world. If they were free to go, they would have left to a place where their talents were more useful. And because of the laws, they're kind of stuck.
No one should argue that the task of migrating to the United States is an easy one. For most, it requires years and years of financial sacrifice. But with 43 million, the United States currently has more immigrants than the population of Canada. And each year we see almost 700,000 of these immigrants naturalized into citizenship. The task for immigrants does not seem to be insurmountable. Isn't America already a sufficiently welcoming nation to immigrants who want to live here legally without further loosening or eliminating immigration restrictions?
Right. Well, so in order to understand how tight the restrictions are, you have to compare the number that come to the number that want to come. So, yeah, so, you know, tens of millions seems like a lot until you realize that many hundreds of millions would like to come. Now, in terms of, you know, are we already taking in too many? I mean, that's something where, you know, there's really two questions you have to think about. So, again, one of them is the moral question of, how bad is it to do this to someone? How bad is it to say that because you're born in Haiti, you are stuck in Haiti and you can't come here and get a better job or find a better place to live? And then the social science question comes down to, you know, is there a good argument for doing what seems on the surface to be a really bad thing to people? And that's why I say not only, you know, are the arguments really not there, but the arguments generally go the other way. There's so many gains, not just to the immigrants, but to the mankind, of letting people move from places where their talents are going to waste to places where their talents can serve their fellow man. You know, a thought experiment that I like quite a bit is to imagine that you've got 1 million farmers in Antarctica. So they're sitting there farming the snow, eking out this bare existence. They contribute nothing to the world economy because they grow so little that all they can do is just barely feed themselves. Now, you know, think what would happen if the Antarcticans were allowed to move to some other place. Probably most or all of them would like to go. They'd go someplace else, the productivity would be a lot higher in another place. And of course this would benefit them, but it wouldn't only benefit them, because the productivity would be so much higher, they would produce a lot more. And what are they going to do with all that extra stuff they produce? They're going to go and sell it on the world market. So everyone who eats ultimately winds up getting a gain out of letting them move from a desolate wasteland to some other place where their labor is more productive. So, I mean, when you think about the number of people who are here, again, it may seem like a lot of people in absolute numbers, but, you know, there's so many more that would like to come. And, I mean, to me, the question is, well, why not? What exactly is the reason to not let them in, given that they would be so much more productive here, they'd have a better life, and while enriching the world at the same time?
In your 2012 paper, Why Should We Restrict Immigration?, you note that, quote, the most popular argument for immigration restrictions is that we need them to protect American workers from poverty, end quote. Indeed, Harvard professor George Borjas wrote, based on his study of the matter, that, quote, illegal immigration reduces the wage of Native workers by an estimated $99 to $118 billion a year, end quote. You acknowledge this as well by writing that, quote, under open borders, low-skilled wages are indeed likely to fall, end quote. And cite Borjas' statistic that our country's most vulnerable financially, high school dropouts, would suffer a 4.8% decrease in wages in the long run due to Mexican immigration, something they can ill afford. With wages for Americans flat by some estimates over 30 years, why should we support open borders if it will hurt our wages and hurt the wages for the Americans, for those struggling the most, even more so?
Right. So just to back up. George Borjas, you mentioned he's generally considered the most respected critic of immigration in the economics profession. And again, what's striking to me is that the biggest pessimist out there actually has a very mild estimate for the total harm. So to be clear, that 4.8% number that you're talking about, that's actually his estimate of the cumulative harm of about 15, 20 years worth of immigration to the United States on native-born high school dropouts. So again, that's not 48%, it's not 4.8% per year, it's 4.8% total. So this is compared to what normal people think, this is actually a very low estimate. And again, there are considerably lower estimates that other people have come up with. But for the general question, it is a general feature of all economic progress that somebody loses. So as a result of the automobile, people who were in the horse and buggy industry lost. As a result of Uber, right now people with taxi cab licenses are losing out. When driverless car comes, then Uber drivers are going to be hit. So if you focus on whoever is losing out as a result of anything that increases total production, you really do wind up complaining about every good thing economically that has ever happened. It is much more fruitful to think about the overall effects than to look around for someone that is losing out. So that is a general point. So now in terms of the in terms of what to be done about this, or how should we think about it? I mean, one point that I make is that given the enormous increase in total production that you get, there's something that is much more constructive than just not letting immigrants come. And the much more constructive thing is, say, let them come, but charge them either an admission fee or a surtax that you could then use to go and compensate whichever Americans you think are losing out. You could use this to fund the end of all taxes on low-skilled Americans. Could it really pay for that? The answer is yes, just because the gains that people get from moving into the U.S. labor market is so large that they could give up half of the gain to the U.S. Treasury and still count themselves very lucky. Even if you are going to focus on the people that are losing out from an economic change, I say it's always better to focus on the cheapest and most humane ways of dealing with the problem rather than just doing the brute force method, which is just saying that because there'd be some harm, you can't come. Which, I would say it's a lot like saying, because people with taxi cab licenses are losing, there can't be Uber, or because Uber drivers will lose from driverless cars, there can't be driverless cars. And really, we owe all of progress to the willingness to just say some people lose, but it's better to have progress than to keep everything the same as it was before.
As a libertarian, you are clearly not someone who shies away from being called an elitist. In fact, one of the more interesting things we found credited to you is the quote, "In a modern democracy, not only can a libertarian be elitist, a libertarian has to be elitist," end quote. Is the open border argument itself an elitist argument, as it, for example, benefits those of us who own fancy restaurants or would be diners at a fancy restaurant more so than those who wish to work as a dishwasher at that fancy restaurant?
Well, so given the vast numbers of people who are very poor by U.S. standards who are kept out, I would say it's not really an elitist argument. Built into our idea of democracy is that only citizens get to have a say. And, of course, most of the people who are suffering from immigration restrictions or the people who are suffering most severely don't have any say at all. This is actually a case where the people that would gain most clearly from freer immigration or open immigration are very poor people, very humble circumstances. Although, of course, really sort of the point of the elitism is to say anyone who has an unpopular view is kind of being elitist by saying, I thought about it, and even though almost everyone disagrees with me, I still think I'm right. So a pretty elitist thing to say, although, really no way around it. And in general, when I sense an uncomfortable implication of something that I think, I try to face it and decide if I really think it. And if I do, then I try to be open about it and say, yeah, that's right.
Speaking of low-skilled workers and wages, some states, such as California, have recently passed legislation that will push their minimum wage to $15 an hour. You are an opponent of the minimum wage, writing, quote, from the standpoint of public policy, the minimum wage is a symbol of the view that feel-good policies are viable solutions to social ills. Quote, workers aren't paid enough? Pass a law so that employers have to pay them more, problem solved, end quote. Would you explain what you mean here?
Yeah, so the simplest argument against the minimum wage is, if it's so great to have a $15 an hour minimum wage, why stop there? Why not make it $100 an hour? Why not make it $1 million an hour? Now, the point of this is that at some point, almost everyone will say, well, that would cause some damage. And why would it cause some damage? Well, if their minimum wage of $100 an hour, then people might decide that they would just not hire the workers, and the result would be unemployment rather than higher wages. Now, then the obvious question is, if you think that a $100 per hour minimum wage would cause unemployment, why wouldn't even a $15 per hour minimum wage? I mean, everyone who has ever been in a sale and seen 10% off and said, 10% off, I'm going to go and get some extra. Anyone who's ever said that is really saying that even fairly modest changes in price will often lead to a substantial change in the amount you want to buy. When people have measured how sensitive is the number of people that get hired to the wage, seems like it's actually pretty sensitive, especially when there's a longer time horizon to adjust, like if you go and you can mechanize, things like that. To me, the minimum wage is something where there's clearly is a downside. It's one that people are very quick to go and dismiss or call it just ideology, even though ultimately everyone believes that this downside is there. Again, maybe my favorite proof of this is anyone who's ever filled out a job application where there's a line that says salary requirements, anytime you have restrained the amount of money that you have put it on that line because you're worried that if you ask for too much, you won't get the job, anytime you say that, that is really an admission that things like the minimum wage have a downside, and a very serious downside of causing unemployment, and especially for low-skilled workers, which may prevent them from ever getting job skills or basic job training. So there's some famous political cartoons showing the minimum wage as knocking out all the bottom rungs of the economic ladder, and that makes a great deal of sense. One of the best kinds of job training you can get is just having a job, and if you're someone who is very low skilled, then the minimum wage is a reason to say, the minimum wage sort of creates a catch-22 where, the only way I'd be willing to hire you and train you is if you already were worth hiring a higher wage, but you won't be worth that until you actually get some training.
You wrote, quote, immigration restrictions trap many millions in third world misery. Economists' consensus estimate that open borders would roughly double world GDP, enough to virtually eliminate global poverty, end quote. Yet, although no major country has instituted open borders for about a century, we have seen the percentage of people living in extreme poverty fall from 36% to 15%. Since 1990, according to the National Center for Policy Analysis. Does this indicate that aid, trade, and encouraging countries to turn to capitalism, as we've seen to some degree in China and India, are far better alternatives for the elimination of global poverty than unrestricted immigration?
So not better. What we can say is that pretty much any time someone moves from the third world to the first world, then overnight they are lifted out of poverty. I do believe that over the course of the next century, that whatever happens to much of migration, absolute poverty is likely to pretty much disappear. So it's a question of should it take a century or should it take 20 years? So, with open borders, we could get the total production of the world up much more quickly. We can basically go and take people that are currently that are currently wasting their talents in the third world and move them immediately to the first world and see enormous gains in their standard of living and world production overnight, or we can do the slow route. So, I'm certainly not someone who's going to say that this is the only hope for the world. I'll just say that open borders is a way that mankind can get to a world of plenty for almost everyone just decades sooner than it's otherwise going to take. So, in the end, things are going to be good either way. But, of course, for the people that have to wait around 50 years for things to get good, it's a big difference.
You wrote, quote, "Before you embrace immigration restrictions, you should still look for cheaper, more humane solutions. They are not hard to find. The simplest is to freely admit immigrants, but make them permanently ineligible for benefits." This reminds of Milton Friedman's observation that illegal immigration is good as long as the people who come in do not qualify for welfare, they do not qualify for Social Security, they don't qualify for the other myriad of benefits that we pour out from our left pocket to our right pocket, end quote. How is telling a worker who would be an American taxpayer he will be ineligible for unemployment should he lose his work, welfare if he cannot find more work, and Social Security when he becomes too old to work, more humane than our current legal immigration system?
Because right now, almost no one on earth can immigrate legally. The numbers are extremely restricted. So essentially, unless you're very high skilled or you have close blood relatives in the United States, you really can never come legally. It's just, you could win the lottery. Even that, there's an education requirement. So it really comes down to, go to someone in Haiti and say, either you can never come, or you can come, you can see an increase in your wage of maybe 2,000%, but you won't be able to get some benefits that you can't get right now anyway. Meaning, for someone who actually is living in real poverty, this is a no-brainer. It's such a huge improvement just to be able to go and work at a higher wage, and the fact that they would have to pay taxes without being able to get benefits would be just, a very, very minor drawback. Just imagine going to the typical Haitian saying, how would you like to be able to move to the United States? You can't collect benefits, but you can shine shoes in Miami, and you're going to make 10 times what you're making right now. Sound like a good deal? And I say that, at least half the population of Haiti would say that sounds like a fantastic deal. What's the catch? Not, it's so unfair. And by the way, when I do offer these cheaper and more humane alternatives, it's not even to advocate them so much as to say this is a lot better than what we currently do. As to whether the additional restrictions are a good idea or not, or the alternatives, it's all a separate interesting question. But just to say that even if the main complaints about immigration are correct, there's no need to actually trap people in the third world in order to deal with them. There are other ways of doing it that are, as I said, cheaper and more humane.
You acknowledge, quote, "another common complaint about immigrants is that they harm our culture," end quote. However, while this complaint from Americans tired of being told to press 1 for English, we are witnessing more severe culture clashes in Europe after they accepted thousands from the more misogynistic Muslim culture. In fact, this clash is so concerning that the New York Times ran a story that revealed that lawmakers in Denmark and Norway are pushing for mandatory classes for these refugees to teach them that rape is unacceptable. Wouldn't an open border immigration system leave America more vulnerable to this sort of problem than a more controlled, more restricted immigration system?
Right. So, the question of immigrant crime in general, which is seems to be closely related to the culture clash. So, at least in the United States, the foreign-born commits far less crime than the native-born. So that is a key fact. And I believe that. So, I'm not sure about Europe. Although, again, it's important to remember that there's a very big difference between crimes that get reported in newspapers and actual crime statistics. So, things that are reported in newspapers in general tend to be extremely vivid, gripping, emotionally affecting incidents, but doesn't mean that that actually you're dealing with a statistically large problem. So, my first step is always just to go and see if it's actually true that the overall crime rates for immigrants are even worse than those of natives. And at least in the U.S., the opposite seems to be true. But again, the other thing is, in terms of cheaper and more humane alternatives. So, if it's really true that Muslims have twice the probability of committing rape than say native-born Danes, you could either go and punish all Muslims by saying you're not allowed into Denmark, including, of course, vast majority of them who would never have raped anybody, or you could just come up with a more targeted solution. So, some more targeted solutions would be some things that are at least less indiscriminate would at least be saying, well, women can come even if not men, which I think would still be a big improvement. But again, the more obvious thing is to more harshly punish actual rapists while leaving other people untouched. So, you know, in general, you know, like if there's a small minority of a group that's doing something really bad, always better to go and crack down on the bad apples rather than indiscriminately punish everyone who happens to be in that group, which seems you know quite unfair, but also also just a very costly way of handling the problem.
One of your opponents in an Intelligence Squared debate on immigration in which you participated said, quote, "I think governments are obliged to discriminate in our favor," end quote. One would think most citizens of our nation, as well as most citizens of any nation, would agree with this. You did not. Why so?
I mean, I was surprised that she'd be so blatant about it. So, how many people would like to go and say, I strongly favor discrimination as long as discrimination in favor of people from my country? All right. Morally, it's hard to understand. So what is the difference between that and saying I strongly favor discrimination by race or by gender or by sexual orientation or by religion? It seems like if there is some moral principle against discrimination, it would apply just as well to discrimination based upon what country you're born in as for what race you're born into. So, I mean, in both cases, I would assume the moral argument is it's wrong to go and treat people differently for something that they had no control over. And in particular, so if you think of judging people by the content of their character, not by characteristics they had no control over, it seems like that really comes down to that is the heart of the moral argument against discrimination. So I was surprised that my opponent was willing to be so blatant about it. I would just say I really don't see any difference between these different kinds of discrimination. If there is a moral, so the moral argument against discrimination, I think, would have to be something along the lines of people should be judged by the content of their character and have basic human rights, and it doesn't and the fact that they belong to a group that either you don't like or that on average has a problem. Neither of those are good reasons to go and say that we're going to treat everyone from that group badly. Now, I think, I think if you remove the word discrimination, then you could get a lot more support for it. So I think that, it's not the sentiment that surprised me so much as being willing to identify, to put the label of discrimination on it, because discrimination is, in most modern societies, seen as being so absolutely evil. My argument against the more normal person who would say, well, it's not discrimination, it's just citizenship. And so, really, what exactly is the difference? Right. And another way that I thought about this is, if it really is all about citizenship, then would it be wrong to go and take groups that you're treating badly and then strip them of their citizenship and then say we treat all citizens equally? So, I had a friend who, when his family left the Soviet Union, they were stripped of their citizenship. So they were officially stateless. Now, my question is, if you think that citizenship is the real heart of what's going on here, then would it be, for example, would it have been okay in the 1960s for the United States to have said, well, look, all Americans had to be treated equally, but we're also going to pass a law saying that African Americans are non-American citizens? Then would that have been okay if you had just changed the citizenship rule? And to me, it seems like the answer is clearly no, because it's not really about citizenship. It's about basic decency.
Kaplanites are quite animated about two projects looming in your future. One is the case against education, and the other is Amore Infernale. Would you preview these for us, as well as tell us what else might be next for you?
Sure. So the case against education is my new book forthcoming with Princeton University Press next year. The heart of the book is something that economists call the signaling model of education. The idea of the signaling model is that a lot of the reason why education pays off in the labor market is not so much that you're learning useful job skills, but rather that you're jumping through hoops and showing off and getting stickers on your forehead so that employers feel more confident hiring you. Now, the signaling model of education has done really well in terms of pure economic theory. Economist Michael Spence has a Nobel Prize for his work in the area. But in terms of actual empirical work or policy work, the signaling model gets almost no attention. Or sometimes there's a footnote saying, yeah, there is this thing, signaling model, but don't worry about it. And what I wanted to do in this book is to take the signaling model out of the ghetto of high theory and say it really explains how the world works. It explains things like how you need more degrees to get the same job that your dad could have gotten with a weaker degree. You might need a college degree to get a job that your dad got with a high school degree back when he was younger. And again, the signaling model, it says that when everyone gets more credentials, the main effect isn't that everybody gets great jobs. The main effect is that you need more credentials to get the same old job. Now, in the signaling model, the key insight is that while education is lucrative for individuals, nevertheless, it can be, and in fact is quite wasteful for society. So, really, the heart of the case against education is a very simple policy claim, which is that we just spend way too much money on education, and if we spent less, people would get less, but also you would need less in order to get a job. So that's the case against education. Now, Amore Infernale is a graphic novel that I worked on about 10 years ago. I can't draw, so I just did it with screenshots, and that one probably is just going to stay in its current form. It'll say like it would cost a lot of money to illustrate, although actually my next project is going to be a nonfiction graphic novel on immigration. So it's probably going to be called All Roads Lead to Open Borders. There have been a number of economists like Jonathan Gruber and Jorm Bauman who have been doing projects, doing graphic novels on to improve economic education. So, Jonathan Gruber has one on Obamacare. Jorm Bauman, the stand-up economist, has one on microeconomics, one on macroeconomics. And so, since I'm a big fan of graphic novels, I really want to go and write the graphic novel that makes the case for open borders and really covers both the philosophy and the social science of immigration. So, a lot of stuff we talked about, but more fun. Right, and my goal is to get a really great illustrator for it, and then have it be like a secondary text for classes in immigration, labor economics, global justice, global development, stuff like that.
If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has been economist Brian Kaplan. Thank you so much for being a guest on our show today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you for joining African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Please join us at www.AfricanAmericanConservatives.com. There you'll find information about our Twitter feed, Facebook page, and our blog. All opinions expressed here are those of this show and our guests. Copyright African American Conservatives.